Hello, 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 everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in today to this episode of The Podvocate. My name is Johannes Alvarez Rivero. I am not only an associate editor for The Podvocate, but also a second-year law student at the Loyola University Chicago School of Law. Really excited to bring you this episode here today. Currently recording in a hotel room in New Orleans, Louisiana, as I'm at a conference where I'm discussing a few of the topics that we'll be discussing on this episode today with a number of other attorneys in the field. So really excited to bring you this. And this is sort of a start of a new series. And it's a series discussing antitrust laws, consumer protection laws, and how they operate within our country, why they were created, and sort of who regulates them, and not to mention any we'll discuss some hot topic areas at the end of this episode, which will continue into other episodes where those hot topic areas are delved into further. But first, let me give you a little bit of background of my story of how I got involved in antitrust. I grew up in New York City. I was born and raised in New York, and I always saw business around me. So from a really young age, I had this infatuation with business and finance. I thought it was incredibly interesting to study the stock market. I thought it was incredibly interesting to study economics, and I really enjoyed it. Now, on the other hand, I had both my parents, and both my parents are not only immigrants to this country, to the United States, but they also spent their careers in service, helping other people, helping underprivileged people specifically around the world. My dad spent most of his career working on economic policy in the Middle East, and my mom spent her career fighting climate change, sort of coming up with these incredible policies for sustainable development. And, they always put sort of business and finance to the side and made this sort of their contribution to the community their primary purpose. And that was something they always instilled in me, was that everyone has a societal duty. And as you can imagine, they were, you got to imagine that they have this kid and they're like, well, how can we have a kid that has this immense interest in sort of finance and business, things that we don't really care about. And then, he's not fulfilling his societal duty. And that's what they felt. They always believed that everyone has a duty to society, a duty to contribute to society and help those who are underprivileged. So this is a balance that I struggled with really throughout my education. Whether it would be in sort of growing up in sort of middle school, high school, dreaming of working in business. And at this time, I was interested in the whole entrepreneurship aspect of business, or whether it moving into my undergraduate degree where I was studying primarily sort of economic policy, or even into my master's degree where I was focused on studying international trade and tax policy. I had a really hard time finding this balance at all times. I was either, for example, I'll take my master's degree, during my master's degree, I was either doing sort of studying economic policy for international trade, which was fulfilling my personal interest, but it wasn't fulfilling the societal duty that I agreed with my parents that people have. On the other hand, I did some work during my master's degree and my undergraduate degree, representing juveniles in juvenile court and working in civil rights, restoring sort of ex-felons criminal rights or civil rights, excuse me. And I did that public service where I worked at a low-income taxpayer clinic. I did that work, and I could see I was making a difference in the community. I could see I was fulfilling that societal duty, but I didn't really know that it was going to be fulfilling to me personally. I didn't feel inspired. I didn't feel sort of mentally healthy with the work that I was doing. Finding that balance between my interest in finance and business transactions and that societal duty was tough. And that was a balance that I did not find until I arrived at law school at Loyola. And when I got to Loyola Chicago, I immediately started getting involved in the healthcare space. Of course, Loyola Chicago has an immense healthcare department. The Beasley Center is one of the sort of standout health law departments in the world. And you know, I got involved in that, and I was sort of, again, I was searching for, you know, I did some social justice work, you know, I did some advocacy work, and I then, you know, I worked on some specific transactions, especially during my summer position, and I couldn't figure out this balance. And it was until that I started researching antitrust when I found my balance. And antitrust is exactly that balance that I found. It was you know, whether it be in healthcare or big tech or wherever, it was this balance that I found of my interest and my passion for working on business transactions, especially international business transactions, and at the same time, fulfilling a societal duty, doing legal work, contributing to legal bodies that their entire purpose is protecting the consumer, making sure that the consumer sort of doesn't face the negative consequences of those business transactions. I mean, again, when we're looking at business transactions, really the underlying principle, the fundamental aspect is money. You know, both sides, the buyer and the seller, want the best deal for them. And when they're talking about the best deal, they're, you know, 90% of the time talking about money. They want to make sure they're getting the best deal, the best monetary deal. And that monetary aspect of transactions is sort of where people focus. But what they don't understand is there's an underlying effect that happens to consumers, people who may have no idea that the transaction's going on. There's an underlying effect, sometimes positive, sometimes negative, that affects consumers. And that's where antitrust laws lie. So that's where we're going to start today. We're going to start talking about antitrust laws, first discussing the purpose of antitrust laws, the enforcing bodies of antitrust laws in the United States. And then I'm just going to go through a brief history of antitrust laws in our nation, discussing some sort of seminal cases in the area of the law, some that you feel free to look into yourselves, either if it seems of interest. And I'll leave off the episode sort of discussing some hot topic issues that'll go on in later episodes. And that's really the purpose of this, is to create a series where we're discussing antitrust, where you know, we at the Podvocate, we're focused on providing sort of people interested in legal studies, sort of an easier understanding of these different topics without needing to sort of read a billion textbooks on them, to have just a basic understanding of where they come from. And that's really what we're going for here today. We're going to go for a series of antitrust episodes. We're not only discussing the fundamentals, but we're also going to be discussing some hot topic issues that could be affecting you as you sit here listening today. So let's look at antitrust laws generally, right? What are they for? Well, you know, this country has had a wild economic history. When we study American history, we're particularly looking at how America has gotten involved in international conflicts. And one of the ways that the United States has gotten involved in international conflicts is with disagreements about economic policy. You know, we look at different types of economic markets around the world. You know, and I think that's really where the United States becomes unique in its history, in that there's been this fundamental belief within American society that capitalism is the best way to go. And I would agree that it is. And I think the purpose of capitalism is this idea of free and open markets, right? Free and open markets are, I believe, how the FTC describes it, free and open markets are the foundation of a vibrant economy. And I would agree. When we're looking at free and open markets, we're allowing consumers to make decisions, and we're allowing consumers to compete, and that's what we want to see. You know, in a thriving economy, in a thriving USA economy, we want to see aggressive competition among sellers so that consumers see a value. Now, you may be asking, well, why do I care about competition if I'm not competing? Well, and that's where we get into the effects of this competition. See, you know, economic analysis over the last sort of few decades, and more than that probably, has clearly shown that if there's aggressive competition within a capitalistic market, you see consumers seeing immense benefits, right? You see lower prices because, again, there's competition. Part of that competition will be who can provide the best product for the lowest amount of money, right? Additionally, you see higher quality products. Again, you know, let's say you're looking at a Microsoft, you're looking at an Apple, right? You want to see, okay, who is going to come out with the better quality phone or the better quality computer at the lower price, right? And then finally, that goes into just choices, right? You want consumers to be able to make choices. You don't want to walk out of your apartment one day being like, man, I'm really craving a burger, right? And then going outside and seeing that the only possible place you can get a burger is McDonald's. Because what does that mean? It means that if you ever want to eat a burger, you have to go abide by McDonald's rules. You have to go abide by what they say a burger is cost. So if McDonald's is the only place in the entire country serving burgers, then if they decide that a burger, one single burger, is worth $30, okay, that means if you ever want a burger, you're just gonna have to suck it up and go pay $30. And that's not only fair to the consumer, but it hurts the consumer's pockets, which is not what we want to see. And finally, competition leads to greater innovation, right? And this we've seen sort of throughout scientific history in this country. When people are pushed to compete with each other to come up with the next best thing, that next best thing comes out much faster because people are being pushed to. They know that they're going to lose the economic incentives of coming up with the next best thing if they're not the first one to do it. So that's why we want competition. So therefore, economists generally agree, especially in this country, that competition is a good thing. And I mean, you see that across Europe as well and in a variety of different nations. So how do we, the government sees this as important. How do we enforce it? Who are we to enforce it? And that's really where the sort of the bar comes in, right? So how can we enforce competition? How can we make sure competition remains and enforce the sort of stopping of transactions or the editing of transactions while still not breaching people's constitutional rights? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, one of the things that we pride ourselves on in this nation is sort of the freedom, our freedom to do a lot of things, and especially freedoms in business. And, you may ask yourself, well, if I'm the CEO of McDonald's and the only other competitor is Burger King, who is it the government to stop me from purchasing Burger King so that I am now the only one who sells burgers? And that's really where the line comes in, is how can we maintain competition, promote competition, but at the same time not impede on people's constitutional rights? And that really comes through with the legislative process of enacting antitrust laws. And that's really their purpose, is maintaining that balance and holding transactions accountable so that competition is still promoted. And keep in mind, this is really industry specific, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But it's really industry specific. Now, let's talk about what government bodies enforce antitrust laws. And there's two primary ones, and we'll discuss the history on when these sort of came into fruition. But there's really two. There's first the Federal Trade Commission, and there's the Department of Justice, which I'll now refer to as FTC and DOJ respectively. Now, the FTC is essentially what I personally find the most enjoyment in studying, because they go at a wide array of transactions. Specifically, they describe that their mission is to promote vigorous competition and protect consumers from anti-competitive mergers and business practices. So that's the FTC. Then there's the DOJ. Now, the DOJ is the only government body that can obtain criminal sanctions for antitrust issues. They also have specific jurisdiction, antitrust jurisdiction over a number of agencies, over a number of industries, such as sort of banks and airplanes and cell phones and things like that, which is why when you're reading antitrust case law, you'll sometimes see it's an FTC suit, you'll sometimes see it's a DOJ suit. It largely depends. But those are the two big government bodies. And this is what I mean when I say antitrust is very industry specific. When the government, let's say we're looking at the, I don't know, let's say we're looking at the hotel industry. Okay, so this is an industry that I haven't done a lot of research on, but if I'm looking at the hotel industry, I'm like, man, there's a lot of hotels. Like, there's a lot of different hotels. So the way the government is going to analyze antitrust in the industry of hotels will be different. Let's say a motel chain wants to buy another motel chain. Well, the government may say, well, the industry here, the demographic that we have to look out here is the hotel industry, and this is really not having effect because there's already a large amount of different hotel brands, and therefore it doesn't really matter, right? So, but let's then transition to if the government is looking at, let's say, coffee, okay, and let's say that like Starbucks, right, wants to buy up, I don't know, Joffrey's Coffee. It's something that I know because it's a popular brand in Florida. Okay, and I know it's sort of everywhere in Florida. So is Starbucks, but Joffrey's very popular. I think that's something that the sort of government would be like, well, the designated industry here is coffee stores, coffee shops, and Starbucks is like the biggest player by far, and then Joffrey's is sort of a medium sized player. So if they're gonna, you know, and then like I can't even really think of another big player that's like a chain coffee place. Maybe there are, but they're probably smaller. And so, you know, Starbucks is, and the government is probably like, well, we can't let this happen, because if they do that, then Starbucks gets like even more powerful, right? So the point of this is like antitrust is industry specific. You have to look at it dependent on the industry. And sometimes these industries can be very broad. For example, if I say to you, telecommunications, you know, that's a big industry right now. There's a lot of smaller industries within that, right? And the government can sometimes look at those smaller industries. Maybe for a particular transaction, they're literally looking at, budget airlines, right? And that's a demographic that they have to convince the court when they're bringing a lawsuit that is the market that they want to look at. And so the court can be like, that's a stupid market because it's not really a market. You're just trying to be too specific. Or they can be like, this is absolutely its own market. There's absolutely its own competitive potential within that market. And that's for another episode as to how that happens. But that's how we analyze antitrust laws. So now that we have like a general understanding of what antitrust laws are, how they function, and who brings them, let's talk about the history of antitrust. And, you know, this is something very theoretical, and it's one of the reasons why I like antitrust is because it's very theoretical. And you're going to see throughout this history in American history, antitrust laws have really shifted up and down. It's like economic policy in that way, in that it's sort of – there are times when people are really a fan of anti-competitive really fan of enforcing anti-competitive practices, really, you know, love bringing down transactions. It also depends on the presidential administration. And then you see times where people are completely against it and genuinely call it unconstitutional. Now – so let's start from the beginning in this country. And again, that's all we're going to be talking about is the history of the United States. And that's really where I want to talk about in 1890, starting in 1890. Now, in 1890, you see this period of boom of industry, right? You've seen this boom of, you know, railroads and mining and these types of things that are just booming industries. But the problem is they may be booming and there may be great economic policy in place. But you're like, well, you're looking at it, you're like, it's the same companies that own the same industries. You know, they have monopolized industries. There's one mining company, there's one railroad company, because of some very smart businessman saw the potential, took a hold of it, and did whatever they could to control it because no one could compete with them. Now, the sort of government at the time is looking at that and be like, we can't do that. So what do? They pass the Sherman Antitrust Act, and that's the first real big law that we want to discuss here. And that's a law that outlaws the sort of quote monopoly. It does two things, right? It first outlaws just plainly monopolization or monopolies. And you'll see in a little bit that this is where it gets a little bit funky in terms of what that actually means. But these are the two things. You know, Sherman Antitrust Act outlaws monopolization. It outlaws also, quote, every contract, combination, or conspiracy in restraint of trade. So those are the two things. And I think you may be seeing yourself, you may be saying, and this is what I said to myself when I first studied this. I was like, what the hell does that mean? You know, like, who decides what is in restraint of trade? Like, what does that mean? And also, like, one of the things that I thought about for a long time was like, isn't the whole point of economics is sort of to be the best, like to make the most money? I mean, isn't that the whole point? And that those questions are exactly what courts struggled with when trying to enforce this. There was a number of sort of court cases that were like, well, how the hell do we interpret this, right? Like, this makes no sense. But sort of throughout more and more judicial precedent, especially when we're looking at presidential administrations such as that of Theodore Roosevelt, that of President Taft, I believe that together they sued or they brought suit against well over 130 different transactions, which at the time is an immense number. This is in the early 1900s. Judicial precedent starts to build up, economic theory starts to build up around monopolization, around restraints of trade. And you get the first seminal case where that really sets a bar, right? Which I really feel like is the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey versus the United States. And this is the case out of the Supreme Court in 1911. And essentially the ruling was that any business arrangement that unreasonably restrains trade is in violation of the Sherman Act. And that's where this term comes in, right? Unreasonably, right? So again, it gives a little bit more color to the verbiage in the Sherman Antitrust Act, but it's still, unreasonably. What does unreasonable mean? And courts still continue to struggle with that, but at least it was, we're talking about a Supreme Court case, Standard Oil Company, that just sets this precedent of that, the Sherman Antitrust Act will simply not allow any business arrangement that restrains trade. Under the Sherman Act, and this is you see this start to pick up in government bodies. The government then sees that sort of the judicial branch is struggling with this interpretation, and so you come to 1914, and in 1914 the government is like, okay, we need to support the Sherman Antitrust Act. We need to come up with a way to make sure that there's additional legislation supporting its efforts, and in doing so, the government's like, okay, here's the two answers: the Clayton Antitrust Act and the FTC Act. And there are whole episodes that could be done on discussing these two acts more in depth. But specifically, we're looking at first the Clayton Act, and the Clayton Act to give a very broad discussion on what it is a sort of legislation that uses that outlaws using any M&A activity. When I say M&A activity, I mean mergers and acquisitions, to achieve monopolies. And it also created an exemption, which was a problem they were seeing in the courts from the Sherman Antitrust Act, an exemption for collective bargaining. Because what was happening was there were actually lawsuits being brought under the Sherman Antitrust Act for essentially trade unions. And that was not the purpose, because trade, I think, generally, people agree unions are a good thing. We want workers in the same industry to have rights and to be able to sort of regulate their work. And so the Clayton Act was like, okay, we're going to support the idea that M&A activity that makes monopolies, M&A activity that hurts trade is bad, but let's create this exemption for collective bargaining. And then on the other side, the FTC Act, of course, not only created the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, is now used very frequently, and is, as I talked about earlier, is one of the bodies that still enforces antitrust laws. But it also outlawed, quote, and this is, again, we get into the problem with verbiage, is unfair methods of competition. So now we're looking at three frameworks, right? We're looking at unfair methods of competition are outlawed. Every contract, combination, or conspiracy in restricted trade restraint of trade is outlawed. And then we're also saying that any M&A activity that achieves a monopoly is also outlawed. Now, again, you're like, what the hell does that mean? And again, I think judges also found it very hard to find that out. And you see sort of the first pushback in 1918. And it's one of, another seminal case, which is the Chicago Board of Trade of the United States, a case particularly interesting to me as someone who lives in Chicago and studies in Chicago. But essentially, the Supreme Court in that case said, just because an agreement or a regulation within a business entity restrains trade or has an effect that restrains trade, it's not that itself is not determinative of whether that sort of policy violates antitrust law, right? And that was the sort of big first instance that I think I really see of pushback within the Supreme Court, sort of saying like this is where the Supreme Court is saying, don't cross a line. There's a line here. We want to promote competition. We want to allow people to compete because we see the positive benefits, but don't go too far as to where you're not letting people have freedom in running their business and being able to improve their family financially. So we see that pushback, and we sort of, it doesn't, I don't think, leave like a lasting effect, because you sort of see going from the that was in 1918, that case, the Chicago Board of Trade case. And you sort of see from then, you know, onwards into the 1930s that especially post Great Depression, that people now see antitrust laws as really important. I mean, the Great Depression had an immense impact on society in the United States. And when President Franklin D. Roosevelt was meeting with his sort of advisors in the 1930s, and he was like, okay, how the hell am I going to fix this disaster, right? He's like, okay, this is one of the ways, is I'm going to utilize the power of antitrust laws to make sure that this type of thing cannot happen again. And he uses antitrust as a way of recovering from the Great Depression, specifically in some key ways, right? So we first looked at an act that was an amendment to the Clayton Act put forth in 1936. And this was the Robinson-Patman Act of 1936. And essentially, it expands what the Clayton Act bans. It's specific, which this is really where, you know, I see really specific language, which I think is helpful for judges when faced with antitrust litigation. You know, it specifically says it bans discriminatory prices, services, and allowances. And it's much more specific than the act, but that's generally the sort of general idea of it. And you can immediately see that courts like this, like the courts are like, holy crap, like this is something we can really grab onto. You know, and first, you see that in 1940, the United States v. Saucony Vacuum Oil Company. In that case, 1940, the Supreme Court rules that horizontal price fixing arrangements are violations of the Sherman Act. Plainly, you know, we say that it's per se a violation because plainly it's a violation of the Sherman Act. As it's price fixing, it's unfair. We want to go back and look at the framework of the Sherman Antitrust Act, right? It says every contract, combination, or conspiracy in restraint of trade is outlawed. So what the court says in this 1940 case is, okay, horizontal price fixing agreements, right? So when sort of a business entity price fixes on horizontally, right, with people lower and higher, with entities lower and higher on the supply chain, that's a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. You cannot do that. It's only further supported when the government is like, okay, this is working, right? We're regulating, we're using antitrust laws to a good effect. How else can we do it? And we pass the Siller-Cavour Act in 1950. And essentially, that act bans consolidation of companies, stocks, or assets, even if there's not specifically market dominance, like even if we're not looking at specifically a situation of like McDonald's being the only place that serves burgers, but just merely a consolidation of company stock or assets that has a substantial effect on competition, which I think is important because now we're talking about real transactions. I mean, again, this is at a time when, again, business is sort of building up. This is, you know, post World War II, and you know, we're seeing a buildup of business, a buildup of the American economy, and you know, there needs to become a way of regulating these businesses from transacting with each other, and that's this act. And we see that the support of this from the judicial body, from the judicial branch, in the Supreme Court's ruling in Brown Shoe Company of the United States. There's a number of Brown Shoe Company famous cases, but we're talking about the 1962 case out of the Supreme Court, where essentially the court said, okay, even in a market that's fragmented, right? So even in a competitive market where there's a bunch of players, you can still block a transaction, a merger, that achieves a very small percentage of market control if the merger reflects a potential trend towards concentration in the industry. So, okay, now we've gotten even more specific because we're talking about, okay, will this transaction, even if this is a, you know, even if we're talking about hotels, as I brought up earlier, they have all these different companies that do all these different things. And we're like, okay, so there's a lot of competition, but would that transaction actually still lead to a small percentage of market dominance? And would it also reflect a potential, you know, let's look at the history. Has the Hilton Hotels been doing this for decades? Are they slowly gaining market dominance to try and to sort of try and evade regulators. But you can see over time that they're doing so. So you see this really, really, this is like one of the golden ages of antitrust, because you're seeing this immense development of antitrust laws, this idea that monopolies are bad, and not only just determining that monopolies are bad, but also seeing how not the per se monopoly is the only thing that's bad. I mean, also the types of anti-competitive markets that are maybe underlying that you cannot see when you're just staring at the industry, but take economic analysis to understand, could also be anti-competitive and be affecting consumers. And so, you know, here we see a real shift, and this is really where the biggest shift comes in. And it's really sort of, I would say, in the 1970s. Early 1970s that this sort of happens. And it's the modern sort of pre Biden administration thought of antitrust reform, because this is something that's been this period of time, the theories that have developed in the period of time post 1970s are expansive. And that's when people refer to the Chicago school or Chicago style of antitrust policies. And essentially, there's a few key figures, and I don't want to go into too many of them. But specifically, we see scholars like Aaron Director. We see judges such as Bork and Posner and Easterbrook, who all sort of have a very different approach to antitrust laws, have a very different understanding of how they should be understood. Aaron, Director, argues that their economic efficiency explanations are valid for some of the practices that that the government has recently prosecuted, has been going after. He releases economic analysis that there are certain anti-competitive practices that actually improve economic efficiency. And this is where, I could go on for forever about economic efficiency and how that actually plays into antitrust. But essentially, this idea of economic efficiency comes into play, where these sort of scholars are seeing, well, government, you've been shutting down all of these transactions, all of these business practices for the last like 50 years. You've been coming up with this legislation, you've been attacking businesses, and I'm going to show you now a bunch of ways in which they were not anti-competitive and you were really just shutting people down for no reason. And specifically, Bork, Posner, and Easterbrook pondered that previously condemned practices actually were pro-competitive, especially if you would have looked at their long-term. And that though they may have had some dangers, they bring in this balance, right? Where, okay, maybe they have some dangers, but actually the benefits outweighed their dangers. And that simply saying that something is per se an antitrust violation makes no sense, because it needs much more analysis after that fact, which is actually something that I think is really important, right? Because I agree in that that's sort of where I stand, that I don't think you can look at a transaction automatically and be like, okay, that's got to be anti-competitive. Because I said before, it's very industry specific. It takes an immense amount of economic analysis. But I think one of the more controversial things that they say is that there's a bunch of transactions that were previously shut down that are actually pro-competitive. And that's a staggering argument. But this became a very, very, very popular theory very quickly. And I think, we can ponder as to how the government was reacting. But I think one of the ways that the government reacted was by amending the Clayton Act to include the Hart-Scott-Rodino Antitrust Improvements Act. And this act was essentially moving away from this interpretive theory of antitrust law, right? Like, what is anti-competitive and not? And instead, all it required companies to do, because I think the government probably saw like, okay, there's all this economic theory showing that we might have screwed up, right? I don't necessarily think that they did, but I think the point is that people were saying that they did. These immensely, immensely well-respected legal scholars, justices, judges were saying that they were wrong. And so the government was like, okay, instead of going after transactions, let's just make a requirement, right? Let's make a requirement, because we see a booming industry, that companies involved in transactions have to make a filing notification requirement to the government in advance of the closing of the transaction if certain criteria are met. And now that criteria has changed throughout since its inception, since the act was sort of put into fruition in 1976. I mean, to this day, I'm not sure. I don't remember off the top of my head what the values are, but I believe like the transaction has to be essentially like $111 million or over in value. So they make that act, and they're like, okay, so at least at this point we can keep track, right? At least at this point we can make sure that the government is aware of the transactions, that the government understands them, and can understand how it can regulate them in the future by changing frameworks. And though this was definitely a good thing, I think you still see that the judicial branch was continuously moving towards the idea that you cannot just say a transaction is a violation of antitrust laws on its face. You need to look at it in a rule of reason, which is specifically the Supreme Court ruling in the 1977 case, only a year after the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. In the 1977 case of the Continental Television Inc. v. GTE Sylvania. In that case, the Supreme Court really took two things out, which was number one, that vertical restrictions in contracts were no longer per se illegal. You couldn't just look at a transaction or contracts between vertical entities, and excuse me, that is the one. Vertical entities would be contracts between sort of up and down in the supply chain. Versus I misspoke when I mentioned horizontal. Horizontal would be like McDonald's and Burger King having a contract to price fix. That would be per se as previously understood. But in this case, the court says, those vertical restrictions in terms of in contracting, right? If I'm a hospital and I contract with a medical tool company to provide my hospital with medical tools, having restrictions in those contracts are not per se illegal in terms of antitrust violations. And additionally, the court says that when we're looking at vertical transactions, you have to look at it under a rule of reason analysis. You cannot look at it a per se analysis. You have to say, let's take everything into account and let's look at it from a reasonability perspective. And let's understand whether it's actually a violation of antitrust laws. And that's really, honestly, that thinking continued for a long time. When I was writing my, I was lucky enough to publish a paper in the sort of fall 2023 issue of the Annals of Health Law at Loyola Chicago. And my article primarily looked at the sort of violations of what I thought were violations of antitrust laws in vertical transactions, especially in the healthcare sector, but that judicial branch and regulators would bring suit, but didn't really know how to bring suit against a vertical transaction, and how judges didn't buy any of the theories that they were bringing. And I think that's something you see today, right? And this Chicago school of antitrust still very much exists to this day. Because again, I think we're looking at the United States. We're talking about the United States. The United States has one of the things that makes this country so amazing is that you look at the freedom that you have in terms of your business, what you can and can't do, but you have a lot of freedom, even though there is regulation. And I think because that's such a fundamental part of our American economy, the idea of putting in regulations that limit people's business transactions, I think is really scary to a lot of business owners and a lot of consumers without understanding that they have an effect on consumers. That are actually negative, and which is why they're there. But essentially, this is sort of where we end. And now we're to today. And obviously, that is not to say there have not been a number of really important cases since the Continental Television case in 1977. Of course, there have been a number of important antitrust cases. I mean, there's many. I mean, there's AT&T, and there's FTC v. Superior Court. There's Palmer v. BRG of Georgia. I mean, you can name a number of them. I mean, for example, California Dental Association v. FTC is a fantastic case in 1999. In all of these cases, you know, you'll see some that are supporting antitrust laws, but you'll also see many that you didn't see in previous history that are criticizing antitrust lawsuits. I mean, one that sticks out to me is Texaco Inc. v. Dagger in 2006, authored actually by a current Supreme Court Justice Thomas. And again, you see that this idea that like they're not buying this per se understanding of how we analyze antitrust laws. We cannot just look at a business practice. We cannot just look at a transaction and say, that's bad, and that's a violation. And so that brings us to today. And specifically, you know, obviously we have an election coming up. I'm in no way want to get into the politics of that election. But the one thing I do want to talk about is what the Biden administration has done. And I think it's bringing in a new understanding of antitrust and a new idea. And if he were to win in November, sort of what does that look like? And you know, when Biden came into his presidency, one of the things that he made clearly at a forefront of his administration was going to be antitrust laws. And though that may not be as like public facing, because I don't think people generally find antitrust as interesting as, you know, standing on the podium and talking about, you know, immigration, gun control, you know, these other economic policy generally, like it's not really it doesn't really like flash out to the people, but he made it a priority. And as you can see in his appointment, and he specifically appointed Lina Khan as the commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission. And you know, she's brilliant, and she's one of the people who have sort of really understood this, what I think is a newer understanding of antitrust. She authored an incredible article. I don't remember exactly what year, but it was in the Yale Law Review, and it was discussing Amazon. I think it might have been in 2017. But she creates this amazing article called "The Amazon's Antitrust Paradox," and it's this, you know, sort of article all about how, essentially Amazon is creating antitrust problems that are not being enforced. And there's a whole nother, you know, how the current framework of antitrust doesn't really allow them to prosecute Amazon. Yeah, it was in 2016 or 2017. And, you know, I think that she's really one of the powerhouses of a new type of antitrust where we're bringing back that like early 1900s understanding of antitrust, like 1920, 1930s antitrust understanding. In turn, she requests like a significant number of money. I think they gave her millions and millions and millions more dollars every year to deal with mergers and acquisitions and to tackle mergers and acquisitions. So I think that's really where we are now. And in the last sort of since the start of the Biden administration, we've seen the FTC go really hard at transactions, not only in big tech, but also specifically in healthcare. You know, you're talking about one that recently just happened, a bunch of just stuff going on in the court system with Microsoft transaction of Activision Blizzard. I mean, that was a huge transaction. I believe it was like $70 billion in value. Massive, massive transaction. And it caused, you know, and she was at the forefront of tackling it. And I think that really shows where we are today. And the court systems today are more and more understanding that horizontal acquisitions, right? Again, which is this idea that it's like a McDonald's buying a Burger King, right? Because they both do burgers, they're both like close to the top of the market, and they're buying each other. That those types of transactions are a lot of the time violations of antitrust. Again, I think courts are sort of more saying like, well, we have to look at the economic analysis of this stuff because we can't just say it's anti-competitive on its face. But what courts are really struggling with is still vertical transactions, which is, again, this idea of exactly what you saw in Microsoft's acquisition of Activision Blizzard. You see a technology company, a big tech company, buying a video game developer of some of the most, you know, influential video games that I know I grew up playing, and I'm sure many of you grew up playing. And you know, you see a vertical transaction, and you see the court was simply not able to understand how it was anti-competitive because the current framework, the current legislative framework, doesn't really provide for a way to understand how a vertical transaction like the Microsoft Activision Blizzard transaction could be anti-competitive. I'm not saying it is or isn't. It's more of saying that, like, I don't think that there's even a framework to understand it currently. And I think that's really where the next steps are. That really is what the hot topic is. You know, we're going to talk in future episodes about exactly in different industries where antitrust laws lie, what transactions have been hurt and not hurt. But anyway, that's really our sort of deep dive antitrust for dummies episode today. You know, I really appreciate you listening. I hope that you learned something. I hope that you could not only see how exciting and how immense I find this topic and how passionate I am about this topic, but also I hope that you got inspired by this topic. And I hope that even if you're someone interested in doing litigation in other forms, if you're someone interested in advocacy work and in social justice work, and you never want to see a transaction in your life, or even if you're not a law student or you're not a lawyer and you don't even want to be involved in the law, but you just think it's interesting, I hope you found some insight, and I hope that you see how important antitrust laws have been to our development as a nation in making sure that we maintain vibrant and open economic markets, and so that, you know, you can go buy your coffee and not be forced to pay a certain amount of money, and so that, you know, and more serious note, you know, so that you can go to the hospital, and, you know, well, this could obviously be debated, but in most instances, not be taken advantage of from an economic sense, because there's at least some laws trying to fight it. But I think what's amazing about antitrust laws is that, as you can see, it's developing. It's an area of the law that is not settled. As you can see, there's a change in theory. There's this balance between actual legislative text and theory that history cannot get in line. And it's still in debate to this day. And it's why antitrust lawyers are some of the most well-employed lawyers in the legal field, because it's always an issue. And depending on the presidency, there's always a new understanding of how transactions can go or how business practices can go. So, you know, I hope you found this episode interesting. Please, please consider watching the future episodes, and please watch the other episodes of The Podvocate. There are some immense the team of The Podvocate are some of the most talented law students I've ever met in my life, and they all have their sort of unique interests that are equally interesting and are worth listening to. So I encourage you to listen to the other episodes, but thank you again so much for taking your sort of 45 minutes today to listen to me. And you know, as always, if you have any questions, you know, feel free to send it into The Podvocate, and we're always happy to answer anything you might have. Thank you again, and I hope you all have a fantastic rest of your April.